Hello and welcome to episode 304 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Chris Weston, Michelle Minikin, and Amanda Brock. Well, hello and welcome back to WB40. Here we are again, and once again, it's Michelle and I. After a gap of some time, we came back last week and recorded the episode with Martin, and we're here again to record an episode with Amanda. So before we get on to Amanda, let's find out what Michelle's been up to this week. What have you been up to?
Enjoying the sunshine. We have sunshine in Newcastle upon Tyne, so I'm surprised it's not headline news because it's been pretty rubbish. Avoiding football as much as possible because, and I spent most of the weekend as the IT person in our business troubleshooting my partner's website. So we thought it would be fancy and have like a fancy all singing, all dancing website, but then across all the different screen sizes, it went horribly wrong. So yeah, so I made unfancy on mobile, which was, that was the highlight of my weekend when I got it to work.
Oh, that's something of a triumph, I would say, getting, you know, something to work on the web. I mean, it's very easy to take the wrong course and that sort of thing. So well done you for pulling it back. And we've got Amanda here, Amanda Brock of Open UK, our friend of the podcast, and who's been very busy because been traveling all over the place and essentially being a high-profile member of the technology community. Amanda, how are you? How's your week been?
I'm good. Well, my week's only just started, but I was really interested in what Michelle was just saying about being the IT person and the weather in Newcastle and saying that she thought it was headline news. And I'm going to share this, although it's got nothing to do with what we're meant to be talking about. But there's an apocryphal story of the Press and Journal, the Aberdeen newspaper, when the Titanic went down. And the headline was Aberdeen Man Lost at Sea. And your Newcastle weather headline just reminded me of it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Funny enough, I was talking, I was in the office this morning. I went over to the Black Country to one of the offices over there. And somebody there was telling me about how they were going to York next weekend. And they were looking forward to going to York. And then they were going to go up to the seaside and go to Whitley Bay.
Whitley Bay? They mean Whitby.
Well, I was saying, Whitley Bay? Why? Oh, yeah, we're going to Whitley Bay. I said, why would you go to Whitley Bay from York? Yeah, it is a long way, isn't it? I was surprised how far it is. And why would you go to Whitley? I mean, not that there's anything wrong with Whitley Bay, but I don't see why I would travel up there. And yeah, she did mean Whitby, but she'd been looking at Whitley Bay and making all the plans around Whitley Bay, which she wanted to go was Whitby, not Whitley Beer.
Even that's a trek from York to Whitby.
Well, it is, but you know, you're going to the seaside. If you want to go to the seaside, it's, you know, from York, it's a reasonable place to go.
It's Robin Hood's Bay, isn't it? I mean, do you know it? Robin Hood's Bay next to Whitby? I went to college in law in York, so I know that goes quite well.
Yeah, Bridlington.
Nice. I've never been to Whitby.
Oh, Whitby's lovely. Oh, Whitby's don't go in the summer, though.
Dracula thing as well, and the Church on the Hill, and that, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those places that I've always had in my mind that I should go to, but never actually got around to it. But
Scarborough's canny as well.
Yeah, I've been to Scarborough and Filey.
Mm-hmm. I've been to Butlins and Filey as a small child. I didn't enjoy it, I'm afraid.
It left its mark. But I know the week has only just started because it's Monday, but the last 7 days, Amanda, what have you been up to?
The last 7 days, we've got a lot going on right now because Open UK increasingly, I think, is known for the sort of reporting and research that we do. And it is always all hands to the deck because we're not that big. So we have a report coming out on the 3rd of July that focuses on something called the Open Manifesto. So for the last week or so, I've been supporting the research team who do case studies and thought leadership things. And we are focusing, as I mentioned, on the manifesto, but that also includes AI openness, which is de rigueur at the moment if you're an open source. And there's some really interesting stuff happening on that piece.
Great. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that later on.
What have you been up to?
Ah, well, I'm glad you asked. It's been one of those funny weeks. I actually went to a place called Caterham. Have you ever been to Caterham? It's down in Surrey.
No. I think
little tiny place. We've got a customer down there. I went to go and see. But that was nice. I've never been to Caterham. But I know that's where they make little sports cars there, don't they? The Caterham Super 7. It's a thing you see around. People race them. Not my cup of tea, but yeah.
Thing that I travel a lot, but you've been getting out and about a lot by the sounds of it.
Well, I went to Caterham. I mean, that's yeah. I can't. I'm trying to think where else I've been. I haven't been that far.
Aspirations of Whitby as well.
Well, exactly. Aspirations. One day.
I want to go to Whitby. I'll come with you. I've not been in Whitby in years.
Right, okay. Right, it's a date.
Your trip to Whitby.
So quite a lot of time spent as well working. We did an off-site day in Meriden. Do you know where Meriden is? Meriden's like, well, it's one of those. It's quite near Birmingham. South of Birmingham, and it's one of those historical centres of the United Kingdom. It's like one of those places that's laid claim to being the centre point of England or the United Kingdom or whatever. And we did quite a lot of work on company culture and things like that. So, you know, it's one of those kind of weeks. But actually, you know, it's quite a nice week, really. I think this week has been encouraging. I think things are starting to move just in the economy a little bit. And I don't know whether it's just anecdotal or vibes or whatever, but it just seems that people are doing more stuff, which is good if you happen to be in business, serving businesses, right? So, yeah, that's been me.
Cool.
I've been hearing quite mixed things around all of that, with people saying that it's a tough year because coming out of, what are we calling it? A downturn, a recession? What are we meant to call it? Hard times.
We are to swear.
Coming out of the hard times we're laughing about.
The shit show.
Yeah, but well, shit show, right. So coming out of a shit show is historically still a difficult year, and that this year has been hard for a lot of people. And I'm still hearing of layoffs and things.
Oh, yeah.
That are coming around the corner, people are getting heads up on.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I'm still seeing people being made redundant in technology companies and things like that. Yeah. It's definitely not all rose in the garden by any means. But when you hear about people starting pieces of work and occasionally people saying to you, actually, I've got my problem at the moment is finding people rather than finding work. And it's just though, you know, the stories, the number of positive ones, the number of negative ones, you kind of, I just got this feeling, but I'm an optimist, so it might just be
good. Know. No, I hope you're right.
Okay, so we're going to go talk about Open UK and what you're doing there, Amanda, and so we'll do that right now. So, Amanda, as I said before, you've been on this podcast a few times talking about the work of Open UK, about the job of being the industry kind of cheerleader for open source software, and how important it is and the kind of things that go on. And you've been doing that a while now. You've been pedaling that bicycle, you know, I wouldn't say single-handedly, but you've been doing a lot of lifting. I've noticed this year you've been out and about doing quite a lot of traveling, and you've been flying the flag, and you've been doing the party conferences last year, and you launched the Open Manifesto very recently, right? Tell us about that. What's going on with the Open Manifesto? You mentioned it just a moment ago, didn't you?
Yeah, so we launched it, I think, within a couple of hours of Sunak announcing the election. So we were way ahead of the political parties and sharing our manifesto.
Did you have any inside information on that? Is that what happened?
Did you go bet on? It was kind of 2 and 2 equals 4, wasn't it? That, you know, it was going to be needed at some point fairly soon. So having it up your sleeve wasn't a bad idea. So we took that form. We shared ours within 2 hours. And that, I think, is quite important because it lays out a stall that we can share with the future government, whoever that might be, as they come into power, with some fairly specific asks around open source and openness in the UK. So we have 3 asks, and we're asking for support on building more open source skills. We're asking for support in enabling the public sector to do open source better. And we're asking for AI openness.
I think we'll probably get onto the AI bit a bit later, because that is quite complex, but it's also a bit messy in terms of what people understand about AI. But in terms of the politics of it and working with or trying to influence a future government, and I saw a poll actually that said that Labour were like 13 points ahead of Reform, and that was amongst GB news viewers, right? So if you're taking GB...
1-3, not 3-0.
No, 1-3, but that was GB news viewers, right? So that's a poll of the people who watch GB news. So I'm thinking, if the kind of people who watch or are subjected to the GB news output are saying Labour's 13 points ahead or putting Labour, then I think they're probably going to get it, right? Then they're probably going to win. So when the government does change and you get the chance to approach them with a sort of rolled up piece of paper under your arm and contain the manifesto, what you what would you be hoping that they would get first or be like most amenable
to? Yeah, I think that the things we've asked for are quite focused. And the first one is around building skills. And we know that the Labour government, Labour Party would be looking at the rural economy in the UK. They're not going to completely ignore the urban landscape, but they're going to focus on rural areas and how they can bring money into those rural areas and create jobs. And one of the beauties of open source is that we can work from anywhere. So when we had a heat map last year with the top 100 contributors, there was one in Barry in Wales, there's somebody sitting in Shetland, and these folk are at the cutting edge of tech, right? They participate in projects, they work for companies, usually out of the Bay Area, and they're really able to do innovative work, able to work and build a career in companies that are international, and then bring in these salaries that sometimes have a regional adjustment. You know, I'm not going to be too much of a cheerleader. They do sometimes have a regional adjustment, but they are more like Bay Area salaries than a salary that you would get working in Shetland generally. Now, there is a beauty of that to those rural areas, because somebody earning that kind of money needs a home, needs a clean air, puts money back into the local economy. And if that somebody happens to be an open source person, the likelihood is that they will also want to, through the values they have, share what they do with other people and share those experiences and skills. And what we're hoping is that we can build a focus on building more of those people across the UK, enabling more people to have the skills, not by teaching them to code, because lots of people have been taught to code and can't get jobs, but taking them from that, having been taught to code, into being employed in the tech sector through contributing to open source. And when you do anything in open source, it goes on to GitHub, GitLab, whatever you're using, but it builds a living CV for you, a CV that's visible to employers across the globe. So we want to build out a project where we have champions supporting individuals in rural and urban areas, making their first contributions, teaching them how to hang out in the news groups, the Slack channels, teaching them how to do your first sort of bug fix, make your first commit, your first contribution, get your first commit, build engagement in that community. And we are very targeted in what we want to do, and that we want to make sure it's people who've been trained in the right sort of languages. We want to ensure that the projects they contribute to are the ones that people are getting employed in. And we think we can probably manipulate the workforce here to build out more skills for our future tech sector, engage people where they'll get roles internationally from the UK, probably keep some of those people who might otherwise have left, you know, and take some of that talent flight away. So that focus on building out more skilled open source contributors in the UK and some funding around that and some support of that purpose in the manifesto, or that ask in the manifesto, is one of the key things. And then the second piece is more about enabling the public sector. So do you want to talk at all about the skills piece before I move to the public sector?
Yeah, but I think let's talk about skills for a moment, because I think what you said there is really interesting, and it's actually slightly different to how I thought about it, because what you're really talking about is that the fact that there are people out there who have done coding to an extent, and it's almost the approach, isn't it? The approach to how you code and the communities that you engage with and how you engage those communities. That is a kind of a learned thing, and it's a skill set which isn't necessarily explicit. It's like one of those things that you kind of imbibe, you know, through it. So it does need a bit of mentoring. And that's a really interesting idea, that you can train people in the approach to the whole thing rather than the technical skills, which are a bit more commoditized.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that already happening. And what we've seen is people throwing education at individuals to try and build out our tech sector. And then they hit a sort of precipice, you know, that lemming falling off a cliff bit. And I know that for a lot of the boot camps and stuff, the employment rates are down in what they were. So this potentially will enable them. It fits, you know, Chris, you know me, it fits into a few things that I want to achieve. One of them is that if we focus on people who haven't necessarily got degrees, but have learned through boot camps, code schools, and encourage them through this process, we're going to get to a socially mobile and more diverse population than we would by going to universities, right? I've been meeting these people through giving them free tickets for our conference, and I've been listening to them. And the feedback we had about open source is it's not taught. So we're talking to some of the code schools about changing that. But also, we don't know how to start, and we're a bit scared of looking stupid. We're not quite sure how to, you know, make that first step. And it's to enable people to do that. Because what I can show you, if you look across Open UK, is people who don't get invited to London Tech Week and who aren't recognised in the UK. But if I was to phone a VC in the Bay Area and say, would you like Liz Rice to speak? They'll jump at it. And we've got a bunch of folk like Liz who are, I mean, she was just given an award for the most important contributions to AWS from the UK. And she's been put forward for like the global pool of people. There's a bunch of people like that that don't get seen. You know, there's hundreds of them, and that they're kind of invisible. And I'm trying to bring them visibility so that they can support building this out. And a lot of them are really hardcore engineers, but there are also the softer skills. We have a lot of community development people, DevRel type people in the UK as well. And I'm hoping that once we get this going on the software side, that we can help build more of those people, because you need that full skill set if you want to have a future tech sector that's in any way competitive to the US's. But it also promises to be more diverse through doing it with the code schools.
I'm absolutely fascinated to understand. So just give a little tiny bit of background. I'm an organisational psychologist, and my focus has been for the last 4 or 5 years is on women at work and all of the different ways that we may undermine ourselves. And what I'm hearing is something that's really fantastic. And it's almost, how do we get women involved in spaces where they may not necessarily feel like they A, belong, or B, that they are even wanted, and developing that mentorship and almost protection, because we all know that the internet can be quite a dangerous, toxic place.
Right. And open source, which you probably don't know, used to have a bit of a shitty reputation in that way. And my take on it is that you had a very elite group of engineers who were going off doing projects that they were super interested in and expected a really high standard of people. Whether there was an element of sexism, I don't know. I didn't experience it. I had quite the opposite experience. But definitely there were not many women. If you look at reporting on it, it's usually somewhere between 10 and 17%. Within Open UK, we're way, you know, we're like double that. And we had 42%, 43%, something like that, of our speakers at the conference were female. So we've really encouraged a shift. But I honestly believe that we can manipulate that UK population and push it forward, and push it not just about women, but you don't see the ethnic diversity that you should across the tech sector either. And by tapping into a specific place where I know that there's a lot of first generation immigrants, that there's a lot of women who maybe can't afford otherwise to learn to code, we can potentially open it up to those people to have that route. Now, not everybody's going to get into an open source community, love it and want to be part of it. But what they will be is protected, because all of our communities have codes of conduct or codes of respect around them. Mm. And I think that's much more progressed than we normally see in the UK tech sector. This isn't what I was expecting to talk to you about, but it always shocks me when I go to events here that they don't have a code of conduct in every room, because we all do. Mm. It's been like that in open source for 5 to 10 years. So I feel that there is a way to bring people in where nobody's going to care, so long as you do a good job, who you are or where you're from, and that we will also have these champions, these sort of mentor roles to support them getting into that community and finding their way. Because of course we have, you know, there's the right language to use, understanding the politics and the people. I mean, that's just life. But if we can enable that, sometimes people have equated it to Google Summer of Code, but Google Summer of Code is a short-term project for a specific number of people. And I don't want to close it off in that way. I want this to be something that could grow and grow and grow. And we're trying to work out the best way to find places that people can go to have physical meetings across the rural areas. I'm not going to share that yet, but I've got a couple of ideas that may work that by the autumn I should know. So I'm really hopeful that we will be able to do this, because I think, Chris, you came to our last conference. The engagement that we had with young people was incredible. And it's because they're coming through in either the code schools or universities. We were giving tickets to both. And they, really were interested in how to get involved and what was going on. And they were a very international group, many of whom I think wanted to stay in the UK, which I found interesting. And when we look at the open source communities we have here, a lot of people have come to the UK to then work for international companies. They don't want to leave Europe, but they know they have to be that step closer to the US. So I think we have real potential in building this tech workforce and bringing more money into rural areas. And I know that others are looking at it, so we need to get on with it or we won't be leading in this.
And, you know, that's it's a vital point, really, about the community and engagement and how it does engage people who might otherwise not have been pulled into it, right, and given the opportunity. So I think it's a really important point. When you're talking about you go into the public sector space, where once upon a time when I did some work with the European Union agencies, they all had a bit of a, yeah, we want to move to open source, but it's going to take a while, and there's a feeling they ought to, but they didn't really. And also, you can imagine, the same as in the UK, really, in the EU, the open source projects aren't always there, right? They're American projects, or they're, so essentially you're add the frying pan to the fire. Now we're no longer in that club. But so what's your hopes for the public sector, Amanda? What would you like to see happen in the next few years?
If you look across other countries, you see a couple of things, and you see something called an open source program office, an OSPO, in many countries. And then you also see some of them developing sovereign tech funds and other funds for open source projects. And we are late to the party. And I like to describe that as a late mover. You're making me worry that I am a cheerleader, a late mover advantage. And I want to use that late mover advantage sensibly. And I want us to look at how we can build on the work that was done by Mike Bracken and co in setting GDS up and G-Cloud, which really has been world leading. And Mike's writing for our report for us. But I'd like to look at how we can build out something that is the next generation. Let's not build an OSPO like everybody else has and do the things that they've got wrong. The European Union has just made some terrible legislation, in my view, around open source. It's probably making terrible legislation around AI. And then you've just seen Apple say that they won't be distributing there. I'm not pleased that Apple won't distribute there, but I've been saying for months that what's going to happen is small businesses are going to block their open source going into the EU because of the legislation. And everybody sort of looks at me like I'm a bit nuts. But now that somebody of the scale of Apple is doing it, it shows you that this is the consequence that you will have if you make legislation that people are not willing to take liability for. It's just insane. So I think we've seen OSPOs, you know, in the EU, like the OSPO wasn't even consulted on the Cyber Resilience Act, we're told, but it's an act that's got loads of legislation about open source. So what I would like us to do is to sit down and look at what's gone right and wrong across the globe, not to build out something new, but to work with GDS and build something really solid in GDS that enables us to focus centrally. Because I think open source, 2 years ago, I think it was 85% of code bases or 92%, I'm terrible at numbers, had open source dependencies, and 76% was actually open source. So when you're looking at the code that they're using, it's going to be open source. But that scale of adoption hasn't been matched in the last 5 to 10 years with scale of understanding. And what's going to happen is people are going to say, oh, this was shit, it didn't work very well for me, and stop using it or blame it. And what we need to do is build the skills, but you're not going to be able to teach everybody overnight. So centralizing that into a stronger GDS as it moves into DSIT if the Labour Party win, I think that would be super interesting. And there are some really strong pockets of bright people in DSIT who've been doing a great job in the last couple of years, and they've been really building expertise and knowledge. And I think we can really admire the fact that they've also said, I don't know when I don't know, and that we need to build skills around this. So what I'm hoping is that within government, we can look at how we learn from others' mistakes and we build out some really strong central function around GDS for open source. And also, I slightly controversially do not want a sovereign tech fund for open source. I do want them to give us money, but I don't want them to put it in a fund. I want them to look at UKRI, Innovate UK, the catapults, and look at how they fund and the criteria that's put on what they're funding, and change it from the ground up so that the majority of what we do is open source and it's properly open source and it's properly managed. And we build out on the skills that I was talking about before that we have in the UK, and we build something that really is world leading. So not that I'm not ambitious, Chris, but I think we just take all the money rather than some of it.
Well, I think that's a fine ambition and no reason why not, really. I mean, there are areas. I was at a Tech UK event a few weeks ago, and presenting was Dr. Laura Gilbert.
Laura Gilbert, yeah. 10 Digital.
Yeah, 10 Digital, that's right, yeah. This is somebody who's got the right idea and is, you know, wants to build open source, publishing mm-hmm. everything in a collaborative way, wants to get the open source community to help out. And that, to me, is a nice example of somebody who's doing the right thing in government right now, and could be the kind of exemplar, maybe, is that you yeah. might be able to then to ask them to build out.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look about a month before the election was called, maybe 3 weeks, so I think the election was 22nd of May, so at the beginning of May, Sunak posted on a Friday afternoon the Inspect AI safety evaluation platform, AI testing platform, that the AI Safety Institute had built. And it's a stroke of genius because they've open sourced it. So the actual platform, the tool that does the testing, is open source. Now, why is it a stroke of genius? They've got the 16 top LLMs already committed to test in the UK. It went up from 8 to 16 between the UK summit in Korea. So you know that the big guys are going to test on there. But there was always this concern about people not being able to test and not being able to test the scale. So being open source, they can effectively self-test, and I assume we'll see some sort of certification criteria badge come down the line after it. They also have entered into agreements and MOUs with Canada, the US, that have been publicised, and I believe there's one across the Commonwealth too, to collaborate around AI safety testing. And they have released 8.5 million that's currently up for grabs around that platform and around the AI safety testing. So that money's available to people, and I'm sure they would like to see open source projects. They would like to see companies that want to build out on that open tool. And that gives us the potential to build an ecosystem. So I think there's a stroke of genius in making it open source because it fixes all these different problems. You build your interfaces, yada, yada, yada. But also it very elegantly does what the EU fails to with the AI Safety Act, the AI Act rather. And what it does is it creates a tool which the tech sector understands to manage a technical problem rather than create a really complicated law that nobody can comply with apart from 8 companies and create regulatory capture. And by opening it up, anybody can access it.
Funny enough, that's exactly what I was thinking as you were describing that, thinking about, because that's the issue with EU regulation around all of this stuff, whether it's mm-hmm. you must have this sort of power connector on a device. And they say they're going to be nimble about it, but they're not, right? They might be nimble in EU terms, but that means in 25 years, they might change, right?
It's absolutely fascinating. And what they're doing is creating that first point of shift. So folk like me have been telling them they need to be agile for years now. You're right, I've been doing this a few years now. I used to think I was new at it, but I'm 4 years in. And, you know, asking them to be agile in legislation. And the way to make agile legislation is the way that you would create a tech business, right? You would sit down and say, here's our end goal. Here are our principles, our key objectives, you know, customer service, whatever it is. You know, you walk into Amazon's office and they've got the same ones that have been up there for 20 years. There's 6 to 10 principles in any of those tech companies. So you set out your objective, you set out your principles, and then the way you achieve it has to be something that meets the industry, and you meet the industry with tooling because that's how it understands how to work and controls its own behaviours now. And then you get rid of all your lawyers.
Those are.
So the ex-lawyer.
you've already removed one from the pool. Let's move on to AI, because I think that is one thing, that area that's actually, it's been in contention for some time, right? Because it's a few years ago, we were talking about, when was it, the Met Police, they said that they were going to use face recognition, and they had to pull it because people weren't comfortable with facial recognition. And that's still almost like a forbidden area. You can't use face recognition in certain areas because, well, I don't know why, frankly, because for me, that you're this is a very human thing. We think, oh, well, yeah, but that's how you recognize people, by their face. But that's just one. It's just a data set, right? There are other ways to recognize people. Computers don't care whether it's a face or any other numbers of data points. But we do. And that's why we get all upset about face recognition. rather than something else. But it's, and that's what I would call boring AI now, machine learning, that kind of building a model that can be used to recognize pictures or that sort of thing. And but we've now got the LLM world, the kind of exciting world of large language models, where the business model appears to be steal as much information as possible to train your model.
One for you, Chris. That's quite controversial.
And also, then nobody really knows what they're doing with the information that's being transacted with it, right? And people have got into trouble, haven't they? I think it was Samsung where somebody was uploading confidential information, proprietary information to LLMs to get them to give an opinion on it. And of course, you've got absolutely no control over where that goes and who's going to the one day ask for a similar sort of information and end up with Samsung's proprietary data, right? So all that is really messy. From your point of view, in terms of the manifesto, where do you see that going?
Yeah, so what we've asked for is AI openness. And I think there's a number of different reasons for that. And if you start at the bottom line for the UK economy, if we don't open up the LLMs, we are not going to be part of the picture in the UK or Europe because the control sits with the same few big companies that have controlled our tech destiny for the last few years, right? And they're the only people with enough money to build it. I was listening to somebody in the EU say that they'd proudly spent 8 billion or had put 8 billion aside for it, and the UK's got 4, I think, and Meta spent 40 so far. You know, it sort of tells its own story. You don't really have to elaborate on that more. So I think we need it to be open. And I think the question then becomes, what does open mean? And that's a point of great controversy currently in the UK. I think I've got a piece that's slightly controversial being published at the New Stack today. My thinking on it follows what's been happening since about December, I think. I think Stanford put a paper out in December. The House of Lords talked about this in February in the LLM inquiry report they put out. Mozilla have just done something called the Columbia Convening. And then two brilliant researchers in the Netherlands have put out another paper. And I can give you all the links if you want to put them in as assets. But they're all talking about looking at shades of openness. Now, the Open Source Initiative is building an open source AI definition, which I assume will be on one end of a scale, and closed will be on the other end of the scale. And in between that, you've got bits being opened up. And when I say bits, you could have your weights, you could have your model, you could have the data being opened up. And what the Dutch people, and I think so far it's my favorite piece of reading, what they've done is find 14 different artifacts that could be opened up in an LLM, in a current AI. And then they've put this table together where they've looked at 40 different LLMs, so Stability, Bloom, Falcon, all their different pieces. And they've marked against those 14 criteria which of them are open. So someone like Stability, who we all talk about as being open AI, Stability, I think, only have a couple of criteria that they meet. Meta's Llama, again, a couple of criteria. You get up to the top, and I think Bloom's up there, Falcon. But when you look at it, what you then have is a landscape of openness. And I think it's really important because if you look at the EU's AI Act, it exempts open source, but it doesn't say what it means by that. And it doesn't use the language that we've historically used as a movement. So it doesn't use the open source definition and licenses that are approved. And it talks about free and open source, but the wording that it uses isn't quite what we've always had. Although we haven't seen the final version, it's going to come out any week now, so it can go live and come into force in August. But there's a bit of a concern there. And the Dutch people have focused on how can you give an exemption if you don't know what you're giving an exemption to, in a very pragmatic Dutch way, which I really like. And I think that's the reality, that we've got an OECD definition of AI, but we don't have definitions of these open pieces. And the reason we care is that they have different impacts, right? So something like Llama 2, which we supported because it's a move in the right direction of opening things up, in its license says that if you have 700 million users, you need to go back to Meta and get a commercial license. So although it's open, there's the potential to control the market and to control the market winners in particular. So what you have to think about is, what is this being open? Is it partly or fully open? And what does that mean? What's the risk? And then who's, you know, how do you manage that risk and who's liable for things? So I think that we've got quite a complex landscape that we all accept and one that's evolving. So we just need to sit down and work this out pragmatically. And for me, that gradient of openness is the way forward.
In terms of the outcome of this, how it affects how we use this tech, there are certain tech that we trust and we use, and there's certain tech that we steer clear from. And again, the face recognition thing, there seems to have been a kind of public backlash. And I think LLMs are starting to get a little bit, you know, tarred with that, you know, where's this information going? How do you think this will affect the way society then uses such things? And do you think that will be able to be borne out in areas where this openness isn't sort of mandated or regulated in that sense?
I don't know if you can necessarily mandate it. I think you could encourage it. It may be that it could be mandated, but you could encourage it and make it beneficial to be opened, and certainly not restrict opening it up, which some countries have been talking about.
I think it's this, like, literally like the Wild Wild West. It's like we are literally making it up as we're going on. And it's, there are actors, shall we say, that may, it's almost like who controls all the information. It's murky.
Mm-hmm.
So who do we trust with our information? And go back to the whole like fake news wave of not trusting experts as well. So there's, yeah, it's scary even on a basic level of who's manipulating who and why.
You use a term there, the Wild West, and I'm very aged and I was around in the dot-com boom. And as a lawyer, I was probably one of the first lawyers in the UK doing internet law. And we used to talk about that being the Wild West. And we tried to manage this new stuff that was evolving using old practices and behaviour. And I make the AI people, when they get stressed about it, laugh by telling them about linking agreements. And we used to do a contract between every two websites that wanted to link to each other. And they were about 14 to 20 pages long, and you'd negotiate them. Can you imagine? So it's just, you know, it's a different world. But we also couldn't foresee what was coming down the line in social media and, you know, the scale of it and the impact it would have. Even when you've got something like Friends Reunited, as we did, you couldn't see that would end up having Twitter or Facebook come in and replace it, or MX, whatever it did. But I think that is why we need that flexibility, and we need to understand that we can't be too rigid. I would counsel that making something open doesn't necessarily attract the bad actors, that you get them equally enclosed. And if you look at things like cybersecurity breaches and people who are talking about paying ransoms at the moment, I don't think it's because it was open sourced. So bad actors will be bad actors, whatever. I think the reality is that you need to look at other things that impact it. And when it comes to our data, in a way, I think the horse has bolted. If you're putting stuff online or allowing it to go online, it's kind of out there, whether it's AI or the internet that's got it. I hope that we'll see a shift in behavior patterns with a generation. You know, I hope that they will be growing up learning the lessons of it and rejecting it, so that the sort of the things that we see go wrong for children today and for adults, I suppose, too, will not be the same issues for another generation.
I think that's certainly a possibility, maybe even likely, right? A couple of years ago, we interviewed a guy who'd written a book about the synthetic generation, and Menno van Doorn, and he was talking about how that, you know, people growing up now have got all of this artificial world in front of them. And you can watch a movie, or that was at the start of the kind of deep fake idea. And I watched a deep fake thing the other day of Keir Starmer playing Minecraft. And it was like perfect, right? It was really good.
Hmm.
It was, but it was kind of obviously not true. And then you've got this into the, well, is the, you know, the way where it's used for subterfuge, or it's used to change people's minds. We've got all that to come, but maybe people growing up now understand that just because they see it with their eyes and hear it with their ears doesn't necessarily mean that it's real, right? Do you see that there was a fraud where it was a company not far from here, Arup, and they were stung by a company that used deepfake technology to pretend to be one of their finance execs and get people in the company to transfer money away. So they were genuinely impersonating somebody and giving instructions to people in that company, and it worked, right? There was millions of dollars were stolen. And maybe people growing up today won't be so easily fooled. Now, they'll have their own technologies to worry about. They'll be new and more and even more sinister, no doubt. But this stuff won't fool them.
Yeah, and I think we have to let everything sort of shake down a little bit, right? It doesn't appear like the end of the world is nigh. And let's just see where this all evolves and how it develops. I'm personally more concerned about the UK not being in a strong commercial position because we don't get access to AI more than I am about HAL or ORAC taking over my life.
Well, another fascinating conversation with Amanda Brock. It is a really interesting time, and I guess we'll find out in a few weeks quite what's happened with the political landscape. And more power to your elbow, Amanda, in getting people to take up these ideas. I'm going to ask you now, what's your week ahead like, Amanda? What's going on?
More of the same, unfortunately, but with good weather, which means that when I get a break, I sort of stumble into my garden and kill snails and pull weeds. You probably need to take that out. I probably can't tell the world I kill snails.
Well, it depends how you kill them, I think. I mean, is it
let's not go there.
Humane? Okay, right.
So, shovel. No, it's so I will be trying to tend my garden in the sunshine in between working for the next week, and then we've got our report launch on the 3rd, which is obviously what everybody's going to be talking about on the 3rd of July before the election.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody will be agog at your report and not looking at polls or whatever.
I thought everybody needed a break, to be honest.
I think you're right.
Election.
How about
fake
you, Michelle?
League.
Yeah.
So continuing to dodge football with a very, very interested 14-year-old boy downstairs. So that's been interesting. So I'm delivering a workshop in a tech company for women, powerful communication. So how to stand your ground, basically. So I'm trialing that this week with a group of friendly women. So that's going to be interesting. So yeah, just work, and nipping into the garden for cups of tea in the sunshine.
Mm. It's not always that easy, you know, that standing your ground, but...
I know. So, Chris, what are you up to this week?
I'm down in London on one of the days. I've got a few meetings, actually, one or two people that I haven't seen for a while, and a CIO water cooler event, which are always good fun. Catch up with a few people I've not seen for a while, no doubt, and make new friends, which is always good fun. So that's essentially the only bit of moving around I'm doing outside of this part of the country. We're getting towards the end of that time where everybody happens to be around to the time where nobody's around, and it gets harder to get things done, decisions made, and, you know, customers or suppliers or colleagues are on their jollies. So I think just trying to get everything settled as much as possible before then, really. And of course, looking forward to election fever, right? The last knockings. And I saw a poll. So there's going to be lots of polls come out. And I saw a poll today, like one of those MRP polls. And they talk about they did the field work from the 17th to the 24th, right? So a week they did the field work. And it was, well, you know, pretty much what a lot of other polls had shown. But they actually, in the report, they said things are moving so quickly and the Conservative polling is falling so steeply, they're probably going to have to do another one because the difference between when they start the fieldwork and end the fieldwork is so great that it almost negates the quality of the start. So if you like seismic electoral moments, this might be the Thursday night for you coming up
hopefully,
in a couple of weeks' time. Yeah, well, I mean, we'll. Fingers crossed, right? Fingers, toes, and everything else crossed. So my week will be doing that, and then we say then we'll be into next week, and I won't be here next week. Maybe Matt and another guest will be here. But all that remains is to say thank you very much, Amanda, for being here. So it's always a pleasure, and we will no doubt all see you again at some point in the future. But until then, bye bye.
Happy election. Thank you. Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on Tinternet at wb40podcast.com and on all good podcasting platforms.